port. It came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'rib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army says Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel, which had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The UAE joined the Saudi-led coalition in 2015 in order to reinstate a friendly regime in Yemen. In April 2018, the Emirates deployed its military to Socotra, an island that overlooks the strategic Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route connecting the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. 2 weeks later, Saudi troops were also deployed there, a move the Yemenis described as a coup against legitimacy. The UAE had largely scaled down its military presence in Yemen in 2019, but continued funding, arming, and training mercenaries in support of separatists in southern Yemen. It became quite clear when forces loyal to former Yemeni government, aided by UAE-backed brigades and Saudi warplanes, reclaimed the oil and gas-rich southern province of Shabwa earlier this month and made advances toward Ma'rib province. However, the Yemeni army's repeated retaliatory drone and missile attacks inside Saudi Arabia and now in the UAE show the coalition is losing the momentum. It has also inflicted heavy losses on Saudi and Emirati-backed militias operating inside the country. Since last year, the Yemeni army, along with Ansarullah forces, have liberated nearly 20,000 square kilometers of land in several large-scale operations. Nearly 7 years of bombing campaigns and blockade on Yemen have proved fruitless for Saudi Arabia and some of its regional and international allies, including the U.S., as they fail to achieve their intended goals. On the other hand, Yemen's armed forces and the popular comedies have grown stronger against the invaders and give them crushing response to their deadly mayhem in the impoverished nation.
For Afghan students, the year 2021 was full of obstacles. The educational system was disrupted and many schools across remained closed, while a ban on girls returning to secondary schools is still in place.
Now the Filimoya school has opened for students in Afghanistan to facilitate learning. This Iranian platform provides Afghan students with free educational courses.
Samira and Fatima are students of secondary school. After being banned from attending their classes, they decided to join online courses.
Hello everyone, how are you?
Now they are students of Filimoya school and they are happy with everything it has provided.
It has been almost 152 days that we have been away from school. We felt very desperate. In order to stay involved with education, my friends and I gather here and benefit from Filimo School's online courses. The lessons and videos provided by Filimo are very interesting and creative.
Teachers and educational consultants believe that online courses are a good means of learning, especially at a time of crisis and pandemic. Mahdi Ishaqi, who is an education consultant, has found Filimo Online School very professional and useful for Afghan students.
I found the Filimo school extraordinarily useful, especially for Afghan students who are affected by a political crisis and the coronavirus pandemic. This is very valuable academically too. I'm sure our students highly welcome Filimo school because they are in need of such opportunities.
Filimo school says it has provided the service to Afghan students because of their difficult educational conditions. So now every Afghan boy and girl, from preschool to the 9th grade, can access the same lessons as Iranians do. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Bedouin Palestinians have been living in the Nakab Desert for decades, even before the creation of Israel. It's home to tens of thousands of residents who view these lands as privately owned. Still, Israel has refused to recognize these Palestinian inhabitants and is now claiming that the lands have been registered and belong to the Israeli regime. The latest incursion into Bedouin territories gave rise to a fresh round of escalation, with angry Palestinians turning out, saying the Israeli forestation project is not but an excuse to force them out of their land.
The goal of the tree planting is to prevent the expansion of the Bedouin villages, to prevent a future recognition in our villages, and this action is somewhat political. The extreme right wing used it to spoil the relationship between Jews and Arabs in this place. We say to them, this is our land, these are our villages, we've been here for hundreds and thousands of years, and we will simply not move from this place.
The crackdown turned violent in no time, with Israeli forces targeting the Palestinian demonstrators with all they had, from rubber-coated bullets and tear gas to stun grenades and skunk water. Palestinian families have been living in constant fear and apprehension due to Israel's forced displacements. A controversial case has been the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Israel has for some time been seeking the expulsion of several Palestinian families from their houses in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Al-Quds, in what pro-Palestine groups have been seeing as the continuation of Israel's attempts at ethnic cleansing and Judaization of Palestinian territories. And the regime's demolition of Palestinian residences and businesses has turned into an almost daily occurrence. Palestinians say settlements built on occupied territory will get in the way of them building their future state. They have demanded that Israel freeze all settlement activity if it wants the peace process to resume. But Israel is pushing ahead, taking no heed of those demands. Some experts believe Israel has been planning from the start to expand and perpetuate its occupation, and the two-state solution was never an option for the Tel Aviv to begin with.
There was never a plan for a future Palestinian state. A two-state solution, so-called, is not a solution. It's a delusion, and it's an illusion that was instituted by Ben-Gurion in the 1920s.
All these developments take place as the international community plays the role of a silent witness of the Israeli colonial policies. And all these Palestinian pleas for help and justice are falling on deaf ears. That has many wondering what can be done to make the world quit its role as a silent observer of the injustice that's been committed against Palestinians.
On Friday, EU foreign affairs and defense ministers concluded 2 days of talks, which were dominated by the subject of Russia. They assert Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine.
Any further military aggression against Ukraine will have massive consequences and severe costs in response. And this includes restrictive measures that will be adopted in coordination with our partners.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow's patience with the West has expired. The Kremlin demands an end to NATO's military buildup close to its borders, and any idea of Ukraine joining the alliance to be ruled out. We have been asking EU citizens to give their views on the crisis.
There will always be tensions, as long as people have different views and are standing in their views.
Just communication and dialogue, that always helps.
I mean, Russia has got an enormous nuclear arsenal. We don't. Well, Europe doesn't. So we have to, you know, tread carefully.
I think we don't need any more conflict, no?
They should just find a middle way to live with each other and don't start a war.
We don't need any war. Of course not. We want peace, all of us.
The EU has donated more than 12 billion euro to the Ukrainian government since 2014. A European Court of Auditors report published last September showed how corruption in the country is rife at the highest levels. During their talks, EU foreign affairs ministers also discussed ongoing efforts to try and get the Iran nuclear deal back on track. France's Jean-Yves Le Drian told journalists after the meeting that negotiations in Vienna are moving much too slowly and a decision must be reached. But back to Russia, and the ministers claim they want more constructive dialogue with Moscow. But impartial analysts are asking, how can they be serious amid relentless anti-Russia rhetoric and the ongoing implementation of sanctions? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, Rome, Milan and Naples, Italy's largest cities, saw protesters railing against the vaccine passports that are now required to access much of public life. The largest demonstration was held in the Italian capital, Rome, where over 5,000 people gathered in iconic St. John's Square to express their anger at the Mario Draghi government's latest COVID restrictions. The new law has expanded the scope of the National Health Pass, which now can only be obtained through vaccination or recovery from the infection. Italy's public transport, restaurants, hotels, museums, gyms and leisure places are required to check the pass before providing their services to the citizens.
We are not against the vaccine. My daughters and I have been vaccinated. Furthermore, we don't hold it against the Italian fellow citizens who got vaccinated. It was their choice and we respect it. We are sick and tired of being considered just numbers for statistics. We are human beings, citizens, with our rights and freedoms.
The organizers of the protest say they are not supporting the no-vax movement, but are very concerned over the socio-economic consequences of the restrictions. Thousands of small and medium-sized companies that make up the bulk of the Italian economy have been forced to shut down due to the coronavirus lockdowns.
Retailers, shopkeepers, everybody knows full well that the new restrictions will hit them even harder. Scientific experts have explained that the vaccine offers partial protection against transmission or of infection from the virus. This green pass is just a way to control us.
Despite Italy recording over 180,000 COVID-related cases on Saturday, the daily number of reported coronavirus infections in Italy has begun to fall in recent days. However, scientific experts say the Omicron wave has not peaked just yet.
On top of the pandemic's socioeconomic effects, Italy is bracing for the upcoming presidential election. Lawmakers will elect the country's next president on January 24, with current Prime Minister Mario Draghi among the contenders. The possibility of a government crisis cannot be ruled out. Max Civili, Rome.
The U.S. levied sanctions on six North Korean officials and two organizations following Washington's rebukes of Pyongyang at the United Nations. North Korea conducted several ballistic missile tests over the past week, including two Friday afternoon. But North Korea's ally China believes the sanctions raise tension. Since sanctions began 15 years ago, North Korea has developed a credible nuclear threat. Pyongyang argues that it has a right to self-defense in the face of U.S. hostility, which includes military exercises of the 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. The U.S.-led U.N. Security Council sanctions against North Korea seek to encourage Pyongyang to negotiate denuclearization.
The UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea are being carried out mainly by the US and Japan, along with several other countries. Hence, if the US and Japan truly seek the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they should stop sanctions and conduct dialogue and diplomacy with North Korea.
South Korea also favors sanctions relief for North Korea, with its unification ministry Friday vowing to continue efforts at providing humanitarian aid. South Korea has also called for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, although the U.S. has shown little interest. South Korean President Moon Jae-in has made repeated attempts to bring the U.S. and North Korea together for a meaningful dialogue. But with Moon's term set to expire this May, this last round of U.S. sanctions will likely deal a final blow to President Moon's peace-building efforts. Frank Smith, Seoul.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioner stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which a constitution, an idea of India which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP in 2014. The community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accuse the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue.
Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence.
Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively. Since last few years, Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. I mean, it is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS. And so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide and rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but thy generosity, and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Saudi-led military coalition has been raining down bombs on Yemen. Tuesday's airstrikes near the capital Sana'a have claimed the lives of at least 20 people. 14 members of the same family, including women and children, were killed in their home. The coalition has staged more than 50 airstrikes across Yemen in just one day. The air raids followed Monday's retaliatory drone and missile attacks on Saudi coalition partner UAE that has been fighting the Yemenis in the oil-rich southern provinces.
On Monday, the Yemeni army conducted retaliatory strikes on several targets in the United Arab Emirates. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the country launched five ballistic missiles and a large number of drones at Dubai and Abu Dhabi airports, an oil refinery in Musaffa, and several other sensitive and important sites in the UAE. Local officials said three people were killed and six others injured after three fuel tanker trucks exploded in the storage facility of an Emirati oil firm in the Musaffa area. Fires erupted in the Abu Dhabi International Airport, disrupting flights. This came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'arib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army said Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. The army warned the coalition of more painful attacks if it continues its aggression against Yemen. The Yemeni military has warned that the UAE won't withstand its future strikes. Earlier this week, Yemen said Saudi Arabia had once again seized a ship carrying much-needed fuel while en route to the country's Hodeidah port. Yemeni officials said the vessel had secured UN clearances to enter Yemen, but it was diverted to the Saudi coast of Jizan. Saudi Arabia has seized several Yemeni-bound fuel ships in recent months, despite an ongoing fuel crisis there. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel that had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The United Nations, however, called on Yemen to return the ship. It also condemned the country's recent retaliatory strikes on the UAE and called for all sides to exercise maximum restraint. It made no mention of the Saudi-led coalition's deadly strikes in Yemen.
And the United Nations has no right to demand that this UAE flagship be returned so it can go back into combat and slaughter goodness knows how many more innocent Yemeni civilians.
Saudi Arabia and its allies have maintained a tight blockade on Yemen, where the population is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Riyadh imposed the blockade in 2015, the same year that it launched an air campaign on Yemen. Daily airstrikes have hit the country, leaving tens of thousands of Yemenis dead. The attacks have increased in recent weeks. Almost 7 years after the war started, and despite all the hardships the Arab country is enduring, the Yemeni retaliatory attacks are driving home the message that the Yemenis are not backing down until the aggression against their nation is ended.
Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who is joining us in this edition. President of the Yemeni American Center for Strategic Studies in the U.S., Abdulwali Al-Aradi in New York. Also to join us will be Yemeni activist and political commentator Hamza Shaiban, who is in Tirana.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now let me start with Abdulwali. How significant is this recent Yemeni retaliatory attack on the UAE, you know, given the huge investments and money spent there to make it a big tourist hub and also a business and commercial hub? How seriously could such attacks impact those sectors of the economy?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me today. Sure. And second of all, it is a very important. First of all, we have to understand why this operation is happening, and why is responsible to. First of all, we look to this operation as a response to the escalation that happened from the United Arab Emirates toward the armed forces of Yemen by the more the aggressive airstrike that happened in Sana'a. In response to the escalation. Especially after United Arab Emirates announced the withdrawal from Yemen. So this is very important to the commercial, because United Arab Emirates economy based in a soft economy. Soft economy need stability. And United Arab Emirates is directed and lead, as we know, by more cooperation. And this cooperation, it have to decide to stay in the United Arab Emirates or not. If United Arab Emirates became a field of a battle or a war inside Dubai or Abu Dhabi, mean it will hit the United Emirates economy very hard. As we know, United Arab Emirates cannot afford the tourism to leave, cannot afford the corporation to leave out of that country. So it's a very significant and a very, very massive to the United Emirates to back up from where their escalation and to do it back up from where they're doing.
Okay. Now, long term to Tirana, Hamza, Yemenis are saying that this attack was just a warning to the Emiratis that have been fighting them in Shabwa and Damara recently, and that more targets could be hit. And also, let's not forget the fact that UAE is much further away from Yemen compared to Saudi Arabia. Your thoughts on that?
Thank you for having me today to speak about this matter. Definitely, you know, when we try to compare UAE to Saudi Arabia, UAE would not be able to stand more ballistic missiles or drones like Saudi Arabia. In terms of size, UAE is very small, although it's further than Saudi Arabia, but also this sends a message to other countries who are involved in the war, whether it's directly or indirectly, like Israel, who has been proven that they're helping Saudi Arabia and UAE in the war in this Yemen. And we all saw yesterday the Israeli media talking about how this is considered as a threat to them. So this is definitely a very strong message from the Yemeni army to not only UAE and Saudi Arabia, but to other countries like Israel. Now, to add to what your guest said also, UAE is a country that have almost 90% of its populations are expats. So people are coming from outside, and this is almost 9 million people. Now, if the Yemeni army continues to target strategic sites inside UAE, we would start seeing people packing their bags and leaving the country, which would definitely cause a further economic recession on top of what the UAE economy is facing right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Abdul Wali, what about Socotra Island in South Yemen? What's the UAE doing there? Paving the way for Israeli espionage activities and taking control of the Bab el-Mandeb strategic waterway?
Look, since the beginning of the war, UAE have their ambitions to control Yemen, Saudi Arabia want to control the Yemen affairs, international affairs, while the United Emirates is acting like a retailer or like a salesman who take places where they could make money out of it. United Arab Emirates, when we begin to think about Yemen, they were thinking about the port of Aden, they were thinking about Socotra, they were thinking about Bab el-Mandeb. As we know, there is an economic war between the United States and China, and who is going to lead the incoming there. And United Emirates has trained the United States in this effort. So this is one thing. And they have to take Socotra to make it as a tourist in places so they could make money out of it. And especially, also, they have to, they already make a solid relationship with the Israeli government. So, the United Arab Emirates right now is represent not just it doesn't represent itself. It represents the United States. It represents Israel. Is the right hand for the United States in the Middle East to do whatever the United States and Israel asking. So, United Arab Emirates is control. Is controlled by the United States. United Arab Emirates is now I consider as allocated as a state of one of the state of the United States. Especially when I see the deputy of the Secretary of State or the Foreign Minister of the United States, or when they said they will punish Ansar Allah for what happened to United Arab Emirates. So we clearly understand. United Emirates is not working by themselves. It's working by the United States. It's working by Israel. So the ambition actually in Saudi Arab Emirates is to make money. Making money doesn't matter who they're dealing with. Doesn't matter what they're doing. Doesn't matter, as long as I make money, I will be there. I'll do whatever is necessary to do.
Okay. Hamza, you mentioned, like Abdul Wali mentioned a few minutes ago, Israel. Could you elaborate on what Israel is doing? Because we are discussing UAE and Saudi Arabia, and you both mentioned the role of Israel here. Let's elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I truly believe that the UAE's role in this war represents Israel's interests in Yemen. The role that UAE is playing in this war is basically trying to control areas that Israel is interested in Yemen. Like, for example, we saw them, they were in Al-Hudaydah before they left to the south of Yemen. They're now in Shabwa. They're controlling parts of, the south where they have, where Bab el-Mandeb Strait is there, which is a very strategic strait for Israel because it's considered as the gate in the south of the Red Sea that allows ships to go to Israel. They have also now military sites inside Socotra, which was reported in Israeli media. And also, for Israel, they want to make sure that Yemen is not controlled by a government that is anti-Israel or anti-U.S. Or they have anti-Israel and U.S. Agenda, because mm-hmm. For them, Babylon to be controlled by a government that is anti their agenda and in the region, it means that they won't have access to the sea easily.
I see. Okay, Abdullah Wali, the UAE scaled down its military presence in Yemen in 2019, if you remember, but has actively engaged in operations around oil-rich Shabwa and Mara provinces recently. At the same time, it keeps training and arming the Yemeni mercenaries. And yet it's saying that it reserves the right to respond to what it calls terrorist attacks, referring to this latest drone strike. Let's have your take on that.
Look, as I said, the United Arab Emirates Act, we never see United Arab Emirates Act. They don't never reply. They just, to me, it's just a lie. They say, we are not there, we're back to Afghanistan. Yeah. While you have your arms, your hand, and today, while you have arms, while you have your hand in Shabwa, United Arab Emirates, it came to Yemen to take their resources. It came to Yemen to take the oil, it came to Yemen to take Socotra, it came to Yemen to take, to close the port of Aden, it is open, it saved 3 days of traveling ships from the United States to United Emirates between, and this will hit, if it's open and work and taken by China, I remember during Ali Abdullah Saleh government, the Chinese government went to rent the port of Aden for 99 years. That means if China taking control of Aden and control of Aden port, the Jebel Ali port in the United Arab Emirates will destroy. So United Arab Emirates is considering more about the money, is considering more about the resources. United Arab Emirates taking gold from Yemen. Stolen gold, stolen trees from Socotra. They just, as I say, it's a commercial to them. It's a money maker to them. What are they doing? Watch what they're doing in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. They very, very openly, more than the United States, more than Israel, more than anywhere around the world, in their hotels and their clubs and their. The only matter to them is how to get the money, how to make money. But we have. The most important today, what United Emirates is considering, and not the United Arab Emirates, just the United States too, they always consider about the curing, the willingness of Ansarullah and the Yemeni forces and the popular committee, and have an attacking United Emirates again. They consider about how long. The capability of the Yemeni forces army in the popular committee to travel for drone to travel for 14,400 kilometers away down from Yemen to United Emirates as my friend said, and targeting strategic bases, vital places in the United Emirates from the point. United Emirates have to think again about their announcement in withdrawing from Yemen, and they have to take withdrawing from Yemen seriously. United Emirates won't act like Britain back in the day. I'm gonna put my army there, like they do in Libya, like they do in even in Sudan. Look what they doing in Sudan, controlling the army of Sudan. Look what they doing in Egypt. Look what they doing in Syria. Look what they doing in many places. They try to control every army around the area. It's directed by the United States, and this is clearly understandable. And the United States, I met with many United States officials, and they always say, Saudi Arabia, United Emirates are allies. They not afford to leave them. They will stick to them. So the most important for the United States, and also for the United Emirates, is how to control the area, how to stop China from coming in the road south. how to get the money.
Okay, it's all about money then. Now, Hamza, a short time ago, there was this UAE flagship carrying military hardware that was intercepted by Yemeni forces. And then we had the world and international organizations asking the Yemenis to release it. But Yemeni civilians are getting killed in their homes every single day. We had just this report of a family, 14 of them in one house. And then there is nobody to pressure the Saudis and their allies to stop this war. Why is that?
You know, it's simply a hypocrisy at its best. Like, Yemeni people have been blockaded for the past 7 years. They've been killed. War crimes have been committed against them on a daily basis. But we don't see any, government condemning what's happening in Yemen and condemning what the UAE and Saudi Arabia is doing. I think they don't want to get Saudi Arabia and UAE upset because there might be some economical benefits between the two countries, or they're benefiting from Saudi Arabia or UAE from from one perspective or another, especially when it comes to arms deals. Many of these countries who are selling Saudi Arabia and UAE arms deals, they will never condemn the war crimes that they're committing in Yemen, because it's part of the deal. You know, we sell you weapons, we get your money, and we keep our mouth shut, and you can do whatever you want in Yemen.
Right.
But there are no options for Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Yemen. They run out of options. Now, there is a new equation in the water in Yemen, which is for your countries to be safe, for UAE to be safe, for Saudi Arabia to be safe, UAE and Saudi Arabia have to withdraw from Yemen and lift the blockade. Otherwise, Yemeni people don't have anything to lose, and they will continue defending their countries. And they actually now have the capabilities and the willingness and the ability to damage these monarchies in the region. And time definitely is not on their side.
Yeah. On that note, I just want to ask Abdul Wali that it's nearly 7 years, since the Saudi-led coalition has staged this war in Yemen. But you see that Yemeni forces are getting stronger and stronger, and Saudis and Emiratis and others are suffering more losses. What's the secret behind this achievement by Yemeni forces?
Look, when your cause is justice, we have a just cause, And I don't know the history of Yemen. Yemeni people never get defeated. They all understand, but they were thinking out dependent in maybe the changing of technology, etc. And they tell them, the analysis told them and advised them again to defeat the Yemeni people in the way you defeat them. When it comes to the Yemeni people, when it comes to their dignity, to their family, they will resist.
Mm-hmm.
And that we all from back history itself. We always resist any foreign interference inside Yemen. So we have the courage, we have the willingness in Yemen to defend our perspective. We'll be able to make the impossible possible.
Okay, good. And one last quick question for Hamza. Many observers argue that this ruinous war on Yemen can be stopped immediately, provided Washington asks for it. Do you agree?
Absolutely, absolutely. This war is a U.S. war on Yemen. Saudi Arabia and UAE are only tools that are being used by U.S. and Israel. We all remember how the war, when it started in 2015, was announced from the White House. And definitely for this war to be stopped, U.S. will have to make a decision on that. But when it comes to Saudi Arabia and UAE, they're definitely only tools that U.S. and Israel are using to benefit from and not to be held accountable for all the war crimes that they've committed. But for this war to be stopped, it's definitely a U.S. decision in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much. Let me thank our guests who joined me in this and contributed to this show. We had President of the Yemen American Center for Strategic Studies in the U.S., Abdul Wali Al-Aradi, in New York, a Yemeni activist and political commentator, Hamza Shaiban, in Toronto. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Limelight. Corporate influence and corruption defines American politics. No wonder most think the country is headed in the wrong direction. We now present you an article written jointly by David Sirota and Andrew Perez. The piece is titled, If Americans Can't Have Basic Things Like Childcare, Their Democracy is a Sham. In 2014, Northwestern and Princeton University researchers published a report statistically documenting how lawmakers do not listen or care about what most voters want, and instead mostly care about serving their big donors. Coupled with additional research documenting the discrepancy between donor and voter preferences, they bluntly concluded that the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. 7 years later, America is witnessing a very public and explicit illustration of this situation in real time, and the country seems pretty ticked off about it. In the lead-up to Tuesday, 2nd of November, off-year elections, and in advance of the upcoming midterm elections next year. Recently, Joe Biden and Democratic lawmakers have been making headlines agreeing to whittle down their social spending reconciliation bill at the demand of corporate donors and their congressional puppets. The specific initiatives being cut or watered down in the Biden agenda bill share two traits. One, they would require the wealthy and powerful to sacrifice a bit of their wealth and power. And two, they're quite literally the most popular proposals among rank-and-file voters. New polling demonstrates the silencing effect that systemic corruption is having on voter preferences. 82% of registered voters support adding dental and vision benefits to Medicare. And according to survey data from Morning Consult, this is voters' top priority for Democrats' social spending bill. Conservative Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona have pushed to keep these benefits out of the bill, following an aggressive lobbying campaign by health insurers who enjoy massive profits from the privatized Medicare Advantage program. According to Morning Consult, another top priority for voters is allowing Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices, with 72% saying they support the idea. Senator Kyrsten Sinema and a few House Democrats backed the pharmaceutical industry managed to block the party's original drug pricing measure from being put into the reconciliation bill. On Tuesday, 2nd of November, Democrats announced they had reached a deal on a drug pricing plan, which Politico, the website Politico, described as far weaker than Democrats' promised legislation. One industry analyst said the deal seems designed to let legislators claim an achievement while granting Big Pharma protection. The opinion poll also found that 70% of voters support including paid family and medical leave for new parents in Democrats' spending bill. Senator Joe Manchin has demanded that this item be cut. After raiding against the Republicans' 2017 tax law for years, Democrats have largely refused to raise taxes on corporations and the wealthy, and their final bill may even end up being a net tax cut for the rich. This, even though President Biden's own pollsters found that raising taxes on the wealthy was the most popular of more than 30 economic proposals they tested during the 2020 presidential campaign. The flip side of all this also appears to be true. Democrats have protected initiatives to enrich powerful corporations, even though some of those measures aren't very popular. One example, subsidies for health insurance plans purchased on the Affordable Care Act marketplace that shower money on for-profit insurers. Morning Consult reports that extending new Affordable Care Act premium tax credits passed by Democrats in March is the lowest ranking of all the health measures included in the poll. The results of this latest middle finger to voter preferences? New polling data shows that almost three-quarters of Americans now think the country is headed in the wrong direction. Taken together, this is the democracy crisis thrumming underneath all the media noise, the day-to-day erosion of democracy by corporations that use a system of legalized bribery to buy public policy, which then erodes Americans' faith in their government. And yet this erosion does not get discussed in a media-directed democracy discourse that focuses almost exclusively on the 6th of January insurrection or Republican efforts to deny election results and limit voting. This is what my 2006 book called The Hostile Takeover, The Conquest of Democratic Institutions by Money Interests, to the point where the world's greatest democracy routinely rejects the common sense policies that the vast majority of voters want and that every other high-income country has already adopted. The hostile takeover is not just the rejection of the most popular policies, it is also the media discourse itself. The Washington Press is constantly portraying industry-sponsored opponents of majoritarian policies as moderates or centrists, and depicting supporters of those policies as fringe lunatics who refuse to be reasonable and compromise. Meanwhile, there is a pervasive omerta that silences most media discussion of the corporate influence and corruption that so obviously defines American politics. And there is scant mention that the moderate obstructionists are bankrolled by the industry's lobbying to kill the popular policies that the American people want. There is some encouraging proof that more and more Americans innately understand the kleptocratic nature of this government and want explicit accountability journalism to uncover it. Also mildly encouraging is the impact of that reporting in the reconciliation bill battle. Democrats tried to get rid of all the drug pricing provisions, but were successfully shamed into adding at least a few of the pathetically weak provisions back in after independent media aggressively exposed the big pharma ties of key lawmakers. It is not a huge victory and not worthy of some effusive celebration of Democrats, because the provisions are watered down and a betrayal of the party's promise to do something a lot better. But it's a minimal proof of concept win. It may at least get the idea of Medicare negotiating drug prices into law for the first time. And as important, it shows that when there is a robust press willing to challenge power, the government can be forced, kicking and screaming, to respond, or at least pretend to respond. It's going to take a whole lot more of the kind of reporting and a whole lot more movement pressure to secure real wins and beat back the hostile takeover. The silver lining here is that at least the takeover is now explicit. The opinion polls show what people want compared to what being excised from the reconciliation bill makes this part of the democracy crisis impossible to deny. And ending that denial is a prerequisite for achieving something better.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.